You're listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 23. Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, where we bring you engaging conversations about wildlife conservation issues from all across the globe. I'm your host, Matt Podolsky. Today's interview is a part of our Science Communicators series. We're talking with Jason Goldman, a freelance science writer and podcast host. It was great to chat with a fellow science-based podcast host who has really put a lot of thought into some of nature's big questions. In addition to Jason's work as a science communicator, we talk about the subject of his PhD research, which he describes as what happens when birds grow up in virtual reality. We'll track Jason's development into a full-time science communicator and chat about some of his favorite science topics to write about. Let's jump into the interview. I'm here with Jason Goldman, who is a freelance science communicator and the host of the podcast The Wildlife, which is sponsored by EarthTouch. How are you doing today, Jason?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks a lot for coming on to the show today. The first question I have for you is, I just want to get a sense of what first sparked your interest in science.
Oh man, in science in general?
Yeah.
I don't know. I always, you know, a lot of people have that sort of story about how they were a kid and first looked through a telescope or first caught a lizard or something. And I kind of wish I had one of those stories, because it would make for a far more interesting narrative, I think. But I don't know. I've always sort of been interested, you know, like growing up in school, I was always into my science classes. But in college, I sort of bounced around from major to major. Eventually, I landed on psychology. And I really liked, you know, I was really interested in learning about what makes people do what they do. I think looking backwards, you know, from where I am now as a science communicator, sort of the steps from there to here sort of make sense. But at the time, I can't, you know, looking forward from back then, I'm not sure I would have articulated the notion that I was into science necessarily, you know, much before college. But once I sort of got mired in psychology and cognitive science and really started to think about, you know, how the mind works and things like that, is sort of when I started, reading a lot about evolution and a lot about comparative psychology and trying to think about where humans fit in, sort of in the broader animal kingdom. And just like in the universe even more broadly, it actually wasn't a psychology class that first got me really thinking seriously about evolution, which I think is sort of what set me down the course of what I ended up studying in grad school. It was actually a course I took in the religion department at USC in LA called Evolution, Free Will, and the Problem of the Soul. And that was sort of the first time, in an academic setting at least, that I was exposed to people like Richard Dawkins and Dan Dennett. And so it was kind of interesting that I was actually in a religion department class rather than like a psychology department class, where I sort of first started thinking about those kinds of things.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely fascinating. And so, I mean, you mentioned that psychology is sort of, sounds like those were maybe some of the first science-based classes that you took at a university. But it sounds like, you know, your sort of driving interest is based around evolution. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, I certainly became that way. You know, I was like, when you're a kid and you're you know, when I would go hiking and stuff in the Santa Monica Mountains or at summer camp, I'm not sure, you know, now I think of that, like, that's clearly about being in nature and like paying attention to what's around you and thinking about those kinds of things. At the time, I'm not sure I would have articulated it that way. I just like being outside. But from an academic perspective, so in some ways I would say that, you know, you could probably, you know, trace my interest in sort of the natural world back to, you know, hiking in LA as a kid. and, you know, having like the animals that we had in our kindergarten classroom and stuff like that. I was we had a desert tortoise that I was completely obsessed with, even at age, you know, at age five in my kindergarten classroom. But from an academic perspective, it was certainly thinking about evolution and thinking about the evolution of the mind and of behavior and things like that, that sort of set me up for what I would go on to study in grad school for sure.
Gotcha. Well, I do want to sort of delve into the focus of your PhD research, because it just sounds absolutely fascinating to me, and I'm anxious to learn more about it because you describe it as trying to figure out what happens when birds grow up in virtual reality.
Right.
Yeah, that really sparks my curiosity. Can you give us a little bit more information on sort of what exactly you were trying to figure out through this research?
Yeah. So it wasn't like so we in my lab we studied chickens. We did controlled rearing experiments with domestic chickens, because they happen to be in many ways a good model for understanding the human mind. And when I say virtual reality, it's not as if I had the world's tiniest little Oculus Rift goggles that we placed on the chickens. It was just that we sort of designed these cages for the chickens, where the walls were made out of computer monitors. So from like we would get the eggs and hatch them in an incubator, and then put each of the chickens into their cage in complete darkness, so they would never actually see us. Like, because we could control what was displayed on the walls of their cages, we could control their visual experiences from the moment that we took them out of the incubator. And by controlling the kinds of visual experiences we gave them on these computer screens, on these cage walls, we could then ask questions about what kinds of visual inputs a mind might need in order to develop, you know, in an expected way or perhaps in a unexpected way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. So what were you hoping to discover through this research? I mean, what was your initial hypothesis going into it?
Well, so to back up for a second, you know, if you want to understand the starting state of the mind, if you want to understand what's really, really innate, you need to start studying. You need to sort of use an organism that you can test on the first day of life. And human infants are not that. And there's a lot of great research in the child development, you know, literature. People who are studying sort of how infants, how human babies think about the world. But a human infant, in the vast majority of cases, is 6 months or 8 months or a year old before they can really participate in a basic looking time experiment, or an experiment that requires them to point to something or reach for something. You know, these are sort of the basic tools that child psychologists have, you know, are looking time and reaching. And those can tell you that those kinds of experiments can tell you some interesting things, but if you're studying a six-month-old human infant, you can't really get at what's innate, because human infants are learning machines, and a six-month-old human infant has spent 6 months learning about the world. So if you really, really want to get to the, you know, the starting state, you need an animal that you can start testing from the first day of life. And it turns out that chickens are a really useful species for that, because they need no parental care. You know, unlike a primate, like a human, who does rely on being raised by older members of its species, an infant chicken is fully capable of surviving on its own as soon as it hatches. It's got good eyesight. It's capable of self-guided locomotion. It can sort of walk around on its own. It can find food and water and all those kinds of things that, like, a human infant has to learn. And many, many infant animals across the animal kingdom have to learn. Chickens are sort of ready to go right away. I'm interested in animals, so I'm interested in animals. And I'm interested in sort of the relationship between ecology and cognition and behavior. In my lab, you know, it was sort of because chickens were the most useful model to understand humans. The same way that in medical labs we use rats and mice, and the same reason that most of what we know about memory comes from sea slugs, because that's the most useful model for those kinds of questions. It turns out that chickens are one of the most useful models for these kinds of questions.
Okay, so you're using chickens as a model to make discoveries about how the human mind works, right?
Yeah, or how a mind more generally, you know, develops from birth.
Okay. So even though this seems like sort of a narrow focus, I mean, you're actually trying to answer a pretty big picture question here.
Yeah, I mean, these are questions that, you know, the ancient philosophers wrote about, right? Sort of what makes a mind. These are questions that Descartes was concerned with, and Aristotle and Kant. And sort of now we finally have the kinds of tools we can use to really get at these questions, which was one of the things that really drew me to this research methodology, this set of questions. And so in my lab, you know, we were studying everything from object recognition to face perception and numerical cognition. And my dissertation in particular was on an aspect of social cognition that's concerned with how we comprehend the actions of others. Whether there's a claim made in the human infant literature and the child development literature that the ability to distinguish intentional from accidental actions is like doesn't require learning, you know, that it's something that we sort of are born with or at least develops without any external experience required.
Right.
Which, I mean, that's a pretty sophisticated kind of skill, it seems to me. And so we sort of set about creating the chicken versions of some of the classic human infant experiments that get at that question. And that's sort of what my dissertation was focused on. And the first of my dissertation papers actually just came out a couple of months ago in Animal Cognition.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Well, congrats on that.
Thanks.
So I do want to kind of get into a little bit of the logistics of how this worked, right? Because I am still trying to sort of visualize, you know, imagining a little chicken or a little chick that just hatched out of its egg, you know, in this room surrounded by television screens. I mean, what are you showing on these screens? You know, how are you, you know, trying to create an environment that will allow you to ask this question?
Right. So another reason why chickens happen to be a fantastic model is that, like some other birds, they imprint onto the first moving object that they see. And so normally, you know, for a normal chicken, that's like, you know, mom and maybe its siblings. And it's motivated to stay as close to mom as possible. It, you know, drives comfort from being in proximity to mom. And if it's separated from mom, it will do everything it can to reunite with mom. So this is sort of the principle that's used. I don't know if you remember the early 90s movie Fly Away Home with a very young Anna Paquin. But that was sort of the movie version of the story in which, you know, a researcher had to train young goslings to migrate. And so he imprinted them to himself. And this is something that even Conrad Lorenz did. You know, he imprinted baby birds to himself, and they would follow him around and swim after him and walk behind him and those kinds of things. So chickens do this. Chickens imprint the first moving object that they see. And if the first thing they see is mom, then that's fine. But this is sort of just a generalized mechanism. And there is, you know, if you give a chicken an option between imprinting to an adult chicken and something else that moves, they'll imprint onto the sort of chicken-like figure. But in the absence of that, they'll imprint onto just about anything. And so that we can sort of use that as a way to probe the way they think about the world. So if the first thing that they see is an animated red circle moving around a computer screen, then they will imprint to that red circle and that sort of mom, and they will follow that red circle around. And if you take the red circle off of the screen for a minute, and then put it back, you know, somewhere else on one of the other screens, it will sort of run across the cage and to sort of hang out next to mom. And we can use that motivation in order to sort of probe the way that the animal thinks. So, for example, if let's say what we're interested in is color perception, whether chickens can distinguish red from blue. So maybe what we do is imprint the infant chicken to a red circle. And then during a testing phase, maybe on one of the computer monitors on one side of the cage, we put the red circle. And on one of the computer monitors on the opposite side of the cage, we put a blue circle. And now we just ask, which side of the cage does the chicken prefer to hang out? If they spend most of their time next to the red circle, then that suggests that they might perceive that color difference. If they're basically a chance, if they're spending half their time on one side and half their time on the other, then that suggests that they might not be sensitive to that distinction, or at least that if they are, they don't use it to make that kind of decision. So that's sort of we can sort of use this evolved mechanism, this imprinting instinct, as a way to get at some of these kinds of questions about how they reason about the world.
Okay. So I'm starting to get a better sense of what this experiment looks like. So I mean, this is what you were doing. You were imprinting the chicken onto this red dot, and you know. So I guess my next question would be like, how do you take that to the next?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like the kinds of like animations and things that we were imprinting to were a little bit more nuanced than that. You know, we know a few things about chickens. Like we already know about their color vision, for example.
Right.
That's sort of just an easy sort of example to understand sort of the way this sort of testing paradigm works. But I was, for some of my experiments, I was using a red circle that would move around, and it would sort of display different kinds of actions, it turned out that the chickens in some ways could distinguish, you know, a red circle that did one kind of an action from a red circle that did a different kind of an action. In some sort of very carefully controlled sort of situations. And in some of the other experiments of mine, I used like a little animated person. I used a graphic animation program called Poser, which is like the same software that they used to animate like the Shrek movies and stuff.
All right.
And it comes with sort of this built-in human figure that you can animate. You can make his arms wave, or you can make his legs kick around, or his head turn, and all that kind of stuff. And so I use that sort of little animated person for some of my experiments. And, you know, some of the other experiments in our lab were using just different shapes and different colors, and, you know, or human faces that varied in different kinds of ways, like drawings of faces. I mean, because the chicken can imprint onto the first moving object that it sees, as long as it perceives whatever you're presenting to it as an object, or an agent, you know, as a something that moves on its own, then if you can systematically vary the way that you present that object, then you can start to ask questions about what kinds of things it's sensitive to.
I guess I'm curious to know what you discovered through this research. I mean, it sounds like it sounds like you were running sort of multiple experiments
and there were a
bunch of different questions, you know, through the process of your research here. But you know, I guess I'm looking for sort of the big picture take home message here, as far as you know what you walked away with as a result of this research.
So for my dissertation in particular, based on what we found, and only one of my dissertation was basically comprised of three papers, and only one of them has been published so far. But the short answer is that these things that are claimed to be innate, or that are claimed to require no learning in human infants, seem to actually require some kinds of experiences, even if they're sort of very simple experiences, or that even if these sort of skills come together fairly rapidly in development, it seems to be that the ability to distinguish an accidental from an intentional action is something that requires experience. The ability to evaluate whether an action is rational or not, which means that rationality is a sort of interesting idea in the action comprehension literature, where how can I explain this? It's sort of a way that you infer the goal of an action. And the assumption is that any action that's goal-directed would be executed in the most efficient way possible. And so that you can sort of predict what the goal is based on the action, or if you know what the action is, you can predict what the goal of it might be. And then if the action deviates from your prediction, then maybe it's got a different goal. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So that kind of reasoning is also something that's claimed that doesn't require all that much experience. And that's even, you know, more sophisticated. And it turns out something like that, I'm pretty sure, at least based on my research, that it requires some kinds of experiences. And that doesn't mean that there aren't other things that are sort of functional immediately upon birth. You know, some of the sort of building blocks of those kinds of skills. So that's kind of, I don't want to say too much because not everything's been published yet. The paper that has come out was basically showing that infant chickens or newly hatched chickens are capable of distinguishing actions from each other. Like, they can distinguish very, very nuanced differences among actions, even if they're made by the same agent.
Okay. And so I would imagine that, I mean, you know, I'm sort of, you know, wanting to take a step back and look at the big picture here, right? Because, I mean, we were talking about how these questions that you were trying to address through this research, that you were really looking to address these big picture questions, right? And so I would imagine that, you know, if this is the case for chickens, then it would have to be the case for humans.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
obviously you don't know that. I mean, I know right. You can't say that 100% one way or the other, because it's, you know, super difficult to design an experiment like that with a human. And obviously
right.
That's not what you did. But I mean, it seems like that would be a sort of the next logical step.
Yeah, I mean, I would think so. And it turns out actually that there are the avian brain and the primate brain, or the mammalian brain, in some ways. You know, they're organized very, very differently at sort of the macro scale. But when you sort of get down into the neural architecture, and this is something where, you know, my expertise becomes less expert. There are a lot of actual interesting similarities in terms of the way different parts of the brain are connected with each other and things like that. So it's not just that, you know, because they're an animal and evolution works the way it does, that you can use a different species as a model. It turns out that there's actually some interesting ways in which the avian brain and the primate brain are similar. So you can sort of get at questions about very fundamental questions about how, you know, how you build a mind, basically.
Sure. And I mean, it seems to me like there's this trend towards scientists recognizing higher levels of cognition, you know, amongst many species, you know, but a lot of bird species in particular.
Yeah.
You know, in recent years. I mean, is that something that I don't know. I mean, am I accurate in that sort of assessment of the sort of the current state of this type of research?
Yeah. I think we're getting better I think we're getting better at sort of testing different species in species appropriate sort of fair ways, for one thing, which sort of gets back to that point I made earlier about how one of the things I was really interested in was understanding behavior and cognition within the context of ecology, you know, within the context of the environment in which an animal or a species lives or evolved. So, you know, there are, you know, like think about the mirror test, right? Which, you know, is when you put an animal or a human in front of a mirror and you draw a dot on its forehead. And according to the way the test works, if you do it with a human child, if the child touches its own forehead after looking at its reflection in the mirror, that suggests something, perhaps, about the way it reasons about itself. But that doesn't mean that kind of a test is a fair way to evaluate every species, right?
Right.
But, you know, so if you give that kind of a test to a dog, it will fail. But if you use scent instead of vision, you know, dogs are very good at distinguishing their own scent from the scent of others. So that's sort of a silly contrived example. But just the notion that you have to treat a species, it's funny. I just spent like half an hour telling you about how we can use chickens to think about people, and we can in many ways. But also in many ways, we have to evaluate a species, you know, within its own context, and by its own rules. I would say that because I think we're getting better at thinking about how to do that. We're sort of discovering some skills and abilities in different animals that before we thought were perhaps uniquely human or unique to primate lineage or things like that.
A lot of my experience in the realm of biology comes from the time I spent working as a field biologist with the California condor down in Arizona and Utah. And amongst the folks that I worked on that crew, we would sort of jokingly refer to the condors in the population as flying monkeys, because so much of the behavior seems so familiar to us, and we spent so much time, you know, observing these animals and getting to know them as individuals. You know, there's only between 70 and 80 individuals in the population, so you get to know each individual animal, and you know, you start to understand different personality traits.
Yeah.
Certainly there's obviously a certain amount of, you know, anthropomorphizing that is going on in that type of situation. But at the same time, I mean, you know, all these folks are scientists, and you know, they are sort of, you know, observing these behaviors with a critical eye. And you know, I think there is definitely something to that, and it's interesting to hear you talk about how similar the avian brain is in a lot of ways to the primate brain. That's definitely something that we recognized, you know, working with that species in particular.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that we have to sort of guard against anthropomorphizing these animals. But I also, you know, we also have to like equally vigorously guard against feeling like we're all that special. And I feel like in some ways the working hard at the first has sort of prevented us from appreciating the second, if that makes sense. You know, both things are true. Like, animals are not people, but also people are animals. And sort of negotiating that line is certainly complicated. But on balance, I think it's probably more instructive to keep in mind that people are animals too, and in the vast majority of cases, we're not really all that special or unique, than it is to. I think that's probably the more important lesson to keep in mind in most cases.
Sure. So, you have this research background, obviously, which we've been talking about, but you also work as a science writer and a science communicator. I mean, I guess I'm wondering, you know, I mean, which came first, or did they, you know, did these sort of two interests, I mean, did they sort of happen simultaneously? I mean, have you always been interested in sort of taking, you know, I mean, both looking at the research and but then also communicating it and finding a way to communicate it to a larger audience, to more than just other scientists?
Well, when I started grad school, I don't think I knew that science communication was like a thing, that it that people did it as their jobs. You know, certainly I knew about science journalists, but I don't think I quite realized the extent of the field. And so, yeah, so that sort of came later, like during grad school, but certainly later. I actually started out in grad school studying, I was doing MRI experiments of reading and dyslexia. And I'd been, I was actually doing that in the same lab that I had been an undergraduate RA in. So by the time I finished my master's, I'd been sort of thinking about those questions for about 5 years. And I was starting to itch to think about other things. And I started to realize that the questions that were keeping me up at night were not necessarily the questions I was doing research on. And like, you know, as you might imagine, there were more questions about evolution and sort of where humans fit into the bigger picture. So I started, I was reading a lot of science blogs at the time, and this was a time when you could just about read every blog post written every day that was about science. Right. Which is not like today. And I was, you know, because I'm a giant nerd and I was a grad student, sort of in my free time for fun, I was reading papers from other fields, right, outside of my own narrow little niche of reading dyslexia. And I started to realize that the kinds of things I wanted to read about on those blogs were not, like there was no one writing them. There were lots of good psychology blogs that occasionally covered animals, and there were lots of good sort of animal biology sort of or evolution blogs that occasionally covered behavior or cognition, but no one that was kind of consistently writing about animal behavior or animal cognition. And I had sort of always self-identified as a writer, and so I thought, well, maybe I could do that. And you know, again, it was a time when there were a lot fewer, like the field was a lot more wide open. There were a lot more niches that didn't necessarily have someone blogging regularly about them. So, yeah, I just started blogging on WordPress. And then within it was actually, I got very lucky. After just a few months, I was invited to join scienceblogs.com while I was still in grad school. And then I was at ScienceBlogs for about 2 years, I think, before the Scientific American Blog Network was founded, and I was part of that group of bloggers that started over there. And by then, certainly, I was aware of, you know, the notion that people were career science communicators, but I still liked research. But at some point, I kind of realized that I liked writing about other people's research more than doing my own, and I liked telling stories. And the kinds of things I would want to do as a researcher moving forward, you know, if I had gone out to try to find a postdoc, I'd grad school, I was in a lab. And so if I had done a postdoc, I would have wanted to get out into the field. And I kind of realized that I could do that as a science writer, you know, instead of chasing monkeys through the jungle with a scientist to collect data, I could chase researchers who are chasing monkeys through the jungle, to get stories. And that's sort of, I realized that's really what I wanted to do. So I sort of leveraged, I sort of took this thing that I did in my sort of free time as a grad student, you know, for a little bit of pocket money, and sort of turned it, just jumped full into full-time freelancing after I defended, and sort of figured out how to turn it into a career.
I think there are a growing number of folks out there who start off, you know, doing research, and then maybe realize, you know, partway through a graduate program, that, you know, maybe the component of what they're doing that they enjoy most is the part where they, you know, take that research and find a way to communicate it to a broader audience. And I think it's important to say here that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not a scientist, right? You're just working on a different component of the process.
Yeah, I mean, I think science is a way of thinking about the world. And just because you're not actively collecting, you know, data in a hypothesis-driven way doesn't take that away. I mean, I certainly I'm trained as a scientist. You know, I got my PhD. I wrote my dissertation. I did all those kinds of things. I still participate in, you know, I participate in dozens of citizen science efforts, which, you know, is also very valuable data collection in a very different kind of way. So yeah, you know, I still think of myself as a scientist. I'm just not actively doing research.
So, I guess I'm wondering, you know, what components of your more formal scientific training, what pieces of that training are helpful in your development as a science communicator, and also if there are pieces of that scientific training that, you know, that maybe hinder that that step.
That's a good question. I don't know if there were hurdles in that sense. There's certainly, I think, having the scientific background, as a science writer, probably makes me better able to spot nonsense when it gets published, or at least to sort of retain my skepticism and ask the right questions when I see a new finding that maybe strains credulity. You know, I think having the scientific background, even if, you know, some press release or something comes across my inbox that's outside of my immediate area of expertise, I think having the background, you know, learning how to think like a scientist, and use your skepticism as a tool, is, I think valuable. I also think having the background as a scientist when it comes to interviewing other researchers, is valuable. You know, my job is to take science and translate it into a way that's understandable to normal people. But if I can sort of speak the scientist's language when I'm interacting with them, I think that helps to establish some level of trust, and familiarity. You know, I can sort of use some of the same jargon sometimes and sort of establish that we're part of the same team in some ways. One thing that took me a while, that may have been a bit of a stumbling block, was just getting used to reporting. You know, because as a science writer, as a journalist, you sort of have to ask the dumb questions sometimes, and as a scientist, you're sort of trained to have the answers. And so there'd be times, like when I was still in grad school and I was, you know, I was wearing both hats, when I would be like, you know, I am the expert. I don't have to ask you this question. I know what you're going to say.
Right.
And I've since learned, for one thing, that sometimes you ask a question even if you know the answer anyway, because you need to get a quote, from a practical perspective. But also, I think I've just gotten more comfortable with sort of that kind of reporting in general. You know, the idea that, you know, we say that, you know, scientists are supposed to sort of revel in their ignorance in some ways, and you know, push hard against their own ideas. But I think practically, or in reality, we sort of train scientists to know a lot of things, and we sort of expect them to know a lot of things. And so those two things can sometimes feel a little contradictory when you're trying to be both.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely something that I've experienced as well. You know, in conducting interviews for documentaries, you know, and especially working on my first documentary film, you know, conducting interviews with people. I mean, I was working, you know, I was shooting for and producing a documentary about California condor recovery while I was working as a biologist, you know, as a condor biologist. And, you know, it's hard to know what questions to ask when you're so embedded, you know,
right.
Especially in a particular topic or in a particular issue. You're like, why would I need to ask that question? Everybody knows, you know, what the wingspan of a California condor is, right? I'm like, well, no, and not everybody does. A lot of people don't understand, you know, that this is a bird with a close to 10-foot wingspan. You know, you gotta
right.
say that. And a lot of people don't have the background, don't understand, you know, sort of that basic natural history. And that's something that you know, that I deal with, and the producers that I work with on our short documentary series, Eyes on Conservation, that's something we deal with a lot, you know, because we're working with a lot of, you know, folks who are trained in science and don't yet have that background in the communication aspect of it. And there's definitely a tendency to forget to ask those really basic questions and to
yeah.
just kind of skim over that base level information, which, you know, for your average viewer or listener, you know, that's going to be their entry point. You know, that's what's going to get them hooked, is, you know, learning that first bit of interesting information about a species or a conservation issue.
Yeah, yeah. Even now, you know, even now that I'm fully 100%, you know, a science communicator, you know, even in sort of fields that I didn't do science in, like climate change, you know, I'm so in those worlds. And I'm so used to reading the literature in those worlds that sometimes I sort of forget, or I have to remind myself that, like, sure, people have heard of ocean acidification, for example, but does that mean that they have sort of connected the dots to understand that that means that the pH is changing? That's what acidification means. You know, the simple things like that are, you know, I have to sort of constantly remind myself are not necessarily obvious or intuitive. And just because everyone knows within this small little community doesn't mean that everyone knows in the broader sense.
So I'm curious to hear how your areas of interest within the field of science have changed, you know, since sort of making this transition into a full-time science communicator.
And I'm still very much interested in animal cognition and animal behavior and those kinds of things. I think I've started to write a lot more and therefore think a lot more about conservation issues more generally. And all of my work still 99% of the time revolves around animals, basically, because sort of in the broadest sense, that's where my interest is, you know, whether it's veterinary medicine or, you know, wildlife biology or, you know, things like that. The common link is animals. But I've become a lot more interested in conservation in general. You know, I've become a lot more interested in urban ecology and understanding both. You know, we're sort of discovering in recent years that there's a ton of biodiversity in cities. And, you know, that probably comes from the fact that I live in L.A., but we're learning a lot about, you know, the biodiversity that exists in places that we don't traditionally think of as biodiverse. You know, we're sort of trained to think of cities as biodiversity wastelands. So I'm interested in that. And I'm also interested in, thinking about how cities affect animal behavior, for those animals that we do find in the cities. So I've been thinking about this. That's to say that I've been thinking about cities a lot. And from a more academic perspective, like I said before, I think a lot of people in the animal cognition world, in the cognitive evolution world, don't always think about ecology when they think about behavior and cognition. You know, and I think that the ecologists and the cognitive scientists ought to talk to each other more. And so as a science writer, I sort of enjoy, you know, thinking about, you know, what are the ecological realities that may have led this particular species to have this particular kind of cognitive skill. You know, what, like, one of the, and this is one of those exceptions where animal cognition researchers are thinking about ecology is, you know, thinking about the distinctions between chimpanzees and bonobos. And it's thought that one of the one of the driving factors that sent sort of the bonobos down one evolutionary line and the chimpanzees down another was their feeding ecology. You know, the bonobos evolved in a landscape where there was plenty of nutrition, there was plenty of food, there's a lot of fruit. While the chimpanzees evolved in a landscape where most of their nutrition came from leaves, which is, you know, ounce for ounce is less nutritious than a fruit. And so as a result, they had to learn how to eat meat, which is a much scarcer resource. And that may have led them to sort of the more aggressive sort of lifestyle that we think of when we think of chimpanzees. That's all to sort of say that I think something that I've been really interested in lately is thinking about sort of connecting ecology and animal behavior in a more integrated sort of way.
Yeah, and I think you've touched on, you know, another one of these sort of really important tasks of the science communicator, right? Which is, it's more than just, taking these science concepts and, you know, regurgitating them in a way that the general public can understand it. It's also about connecting, you know, these different, you know, specific areas of science and bringing them together in a way that, you know, even those researchers working in that particular field might have never thought of.
Yeah, yeah. I think we have an interesting role, you know, because we can sort of step back and take in a sort of broader perspective. I think we might be able to notice connections that might be missed if you're too zoomed in, you know, onto your, you know, very particular set of research questions. That's one of the things I like about being a science communicator is being able to take those steps back and to see those parallels between disparate fields, see those connections. And that's something that some researchers do very well, certainly. But I think it's something that science communicators can certainly have a role in helping with.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I kind of want to get your perspective on, you know, how you see the role of or what role you see new media specifically is playing in the science communication field. And I mean, this was sort of your entry point into the field. So I'm curious to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, I don't know if it makes sense anymore to draw these sort of artificial boundaries between new media and old media. You know, even the oldest newspapers are online and are on Instagram and are Snapchatting and, you know, all these kinds of things. So, you know, I think of science, I think of sort of the science communication ecosystem. You know, there's a lot of different trophic levels. You know, there are certain things, certain kinds of stories, and certain kinds of communication efforts that work best in tweet form or in a 2 or 3 minute YouTube video or via Instagram. And then there are some kinds of stories that work best via an 800 word blog post. There's some kinds of stories that you need an 80,000 word book. There's some kind of stories that you need book length, but you need multimedia. So maybe the ebook is the right, you know, the right kind of thing. I think these are all tools that we can use to tell stories. And I think a story can be a 140 character tweet, and it can be a 100,000 word book. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. And that's different from asking the question about how to make a sustainable living as a science communicator. But, you know, because no one's paying you to tweet. But if we sort of take that aspect out of it, I think that, you know, I think it's an ecosystem. And you need all of the different pieces in order to have a functional ecosystem, because you're going to get different audiences in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's a really great way to think about it. Actually, I like that a lot. You know, thinking of, you know, these developments in new media and technology as just sort of expanding our range of options as far as how we reach out to people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of your science communication efforts are going to be the plankton, and some of them are going to be the great white sharks. Right. But if you get rid of one, the other, like down the line, you know, that there will be a trophic cascade. Right. If you take the wolves out of Yellowstone, you're going to have problems.
Yeah, that's great. I think, I mean, maybe you've already done this, but I mean, man, that'd be a great blog post, you know, or great article, right? So the trophic levels of science communication.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not a perfect analogy, but it is absolutely an ecosystem.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Well, thanks a lot, Jason, for coming on to the show and sharing this sort of vast array of knowledge. I mean, going from your research interests through your transition into a science communicator. Very interesting stuff.
Thanks for having me.
All right. That was Jason Goldman, host of the Wildlife Podcast. I love how Jason describes all the different avenues of communicating science to the public as an ecosystem, with each communication medium filling its own important niche. I'd like to think that he just came up with that one on the spot through the inspiration provided by being a guest on our show, but I can't say that for certain. But what a fascinating interview with a great science communicator who's working to bring together these fields of animal cognition and ecology, among many other things, of course. If you enjoyed today's interview, be sure to check out Jason's podcast, The Wild Life, which you can find over on the website for the Earth Touch Network, or on the iTunes Store and other podcatchers, of course. We'll include links to his show on the show notes page for this website, which, of course, you can find at wildlensinc.org/EOC23. That's wildlensinc.org/EOC23. The Eyes on Conservation podcast is produced by myself, your host, Matt Podolsky. Our theme music is by The Humidors.